Mr. Shays, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kevin Shays, and I'm one of the counsel for 12 community petitioners, all government agencies charged with responsibility to protect the health and safety of their residents who live along the EJ&E line. This case will allow Canadian National to change the EJ&E line into a major link at the center of its transcontinental North American railroad network. CN will add between 15 and 24 trains per day to a line that saw three or four trains per day before the transaction. The transaction will have the most significant, concentrated environmental impact of any railroad combination in the last 30 years at least. Yet even knowing all of this, the STB abdicated its NEPA responsibility in this case. It abdicated when it accepted CN's hand-picked consultant.
And is there any evidence that what you phrase is their hand-picked consultant, is there any evidence that that compromised the integrity of the NEPA review?
Yes, Your Honor, there is. If they did not solely select the consultant themselves, then the court will need to look at how they supervised the consultant.
I understand your argument about solely, but let's imagine I agreed with you that they didn't go through the right process. Is there any evidence that using HTR tainted the evidence, other than the fact of some irregularity in procedure? I'm not certain I agree with you on that, but what I want to get at is there any evidence that HDR tainted the outcome?
Yes, Your Honor. The way you get to that question is to look at whether the STB supervised the consultant. And the only evidence that's...
I guess what I'm getting at is it would have been a different outcome with a different consultant. What's the evidence that it would have been any different?
The evidence that it would have been different is that, well, it does, Your Honor, it depends on the supervision. If HDR was not adequately supervised, then there's a chance, and it's a fact issue, that they felt pressure to rush the decision. Because in the absence of...
The evidence of that is just surmise on your part.
The evidence of it is that it took 66 days to turn an FEIS after a 7,000-page DEIS and 8,500 comments. And the absence of clear indication about selection and about supervision raises a question about whether HDR had a bias.
Well, can I ask you, I guess I have an antecedent question to ask you, which is that the consultant, CN had to pick the consultant from an approved list, right, of consultants that had experience in environmental issues in the railroad industry.
Right? The board has an approved list of consultants. Right. What the CEQ regs require, Your Honor, is that the board select a consultant.
Well, but if the board, suppose the list had consisted of two, not 70, just two. And they said, okay, which one do you want? And then the railroad picked consultant A, and they said, and the board approved that selection. Wouldn't that be completely adequate?
If there were two, your question is if there were two on the list, yeah, and the board picked one.
No, that's not my question. Is there's two on the list, and they say to the consultant, they say to the railroad, pick one. And the railroad picks A and says, and then the board approves the selection of A. Isn't it obvious that that complies with the guidelines?
Your Honor, I don't think it is obvious because even in that hypothetical, the board did not solely select; they let CN pick, and they're supposed to, under the CEQ regs, solely select, and that did not happen. So you do get to the issue of supervision, and on supervision, there is very little indication in the record that they were adequately supervised. What you do know is that there were four STB staff that were to supervise.
You would want a remand for fact-finding on that?
Yes, we would want a remand for fact-finding on the question of whether, on that question, Your Honor.
Suppose we didn't think that, and I'm not signaling anything here, I'm just asking you the question so I know how to think about it. Suppose we didn't, given the deferential standard by which we review decisions of this kind, suppose we didn't think you had really given us any basis for second-guessing any of the board's environmental judgments here. In other words, if this is your last issue, there's nothing else left, why would we have to even address it?
Well, because it's...
In other words, if you've identified no problem that in the way the board proceeded, what difference does it make how they pick their consultant?
I think we have identified a problem,
but,
Your
but
Honor.
But that's not my hypothetical, is that you haven't.
If we have not,
and
we have no other issues...
Then this is not a basis for setting aside what the board did. Right?
If there's no bias and there are no other issues...
That's not what I said.
I'm sorry.
You've listed seven or eight issues in your brief, concerns about how the board proceeded here, right?
Correct.
Now suppose you lose on all of them. Do we have to decide this one?
If we lose on all of the other issues, then there's an open fact question about appointment and supervision, and this issue would remain open and would need to be decided.
Okay. All right. What, of all the issues you've raised, what do you think is your strongest?
Your Honor, we think that the board's failure to develop adequate alternatives and put those alternatives out to the public for comparison, which is the heart of an EIS process, was a fundamental failure, and that everything that happened after that was premised upon a failure to adequately develop alternatives. There are specific issues pertaining to comments that were not responded to, including vital issues about hazmat, spills, and traffic impacts. But all of it was flawed by a failure to put out comparable options. And the board's answer to our criticism about the failure to put out adequate alternatives is that the things that were suggested as alternatives by members of the public and the petitioners were not things that the board traditionally does in a railroad merger. And we think that's that's not an answer, that alternatives are supposed to be developed if feasible. And the fact that the board may not ever have used alternatives like the ones proposed is not an answer on feasibility. The traffic impact is also a very important issue. The board changed methodologies on the measurement of roadway impact issues in Barrington. Barrington's comments said, your methodology doesn't adequately measure impacts. Here's our study using your same measurement criteria.
Is that the Barrington traffic study you're talking about?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. I noticed you made, you argued that quite strenuously, the traffic study in the reply brief here, but I didn't see a reference to it in your opening brief. Did I miss it?
Yes, Your Honor. There is a reference to it in the opening brief. We identified the traffic impact problem.
No, I know, but did you make the point? I mean, your point, I take it, is that the Barrington traffic study showed it over the threshold, whereas the boards showed it under the threshold. So if the Barrington traffic study was right, it was obviously something the board had to respond to, right?
Correct.
But where did you make that argument in the blue brief?
I will give you a page cite in my rebuttal time.
That's fine. But I want to know not just where you argued about traffic, but where you argued about the Barrington traffic study.
Understood. I can tell you that our decision to use to fully develop the argument in the reply brief was based upon the board's brief statement that they had concluded that the impact...
Sure, but you understand why I'm asking the question.
Yes, yes, Your Honor, I do. The final thing I'd like to point out is that on hazmat transport, another vital issue in the case, hazmat transport on the line is going to increase as a result of this transaction 7 to 10-fold. The Department of Interior commented that the board ought to study pesticide spill containment in wildlife areas along the line, because spill cleanup, according to the Department of Interior, would not save endangered wildlife. The board declined to even study spill containment.
Didn't it say that it thought that existing environmental laws were adequate? I mean, it didn't ignore that comment, did it? It just thought that existing environmental laws were adequate.
Your Honor, the argument was not just that. In fact, the response to this comment about the possibility of doing a study was that a study would be speculative, that a study would be meaningless, and that there were too many things that could spill in too many places, and that weather conditions could affect, and so there's no reason to study it. But the request was about a study for pesticides and herbicides on specific spots on the line where there was wildlife. It's a much smaller ask than the board turned it into in its justification for not doing the study. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Cunningham.
Dangerous. Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. I'm here on behalf of Canadian National, the petitioner and intervener in this case, and its subsidiary Grand Trunk. If I may, subject to your questions, I would like to address briefly three topics: the statute at issue, the STB's abuse of discretion in ordering grade separations below, and why there is no waiver issue.
Why there's no what?
Waiver issue. In 1980, Congress enacted what is now 49 U.S.C. 11324D1. It required the STB to authorize non-major rail transactions unless it finds the acquisition is likely to harm competition.
Yeah, we know the statute. Let's just get to the core of this, okay?
Well, let's get that. I would be delighted to get to that.
Let me see if...
I think the core...
I was going to ask you a question.
Please ask me a question.
Yeah. What we have here, we have a situation where we all agree, right, and you agree, that pre-Staggers, the Interstate Commerce Commission had environmental conditioning authority, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And the Staggers Act didn't repeal or significantly amend subsection D in section 324. It added D. I mean, subsection C, it added D, right? That's what happened here.
Before I answer the second question,
yeah.
The answer to the first question is, it had general public interest conditioning and conditioning.
Well, but that included environmental conditioning. You don't think
as
so?
As the board notes, as of 1980, had not been a significant
but
issue.
But since the mid-90s, the board has been...
Absolutely.
Okay, and there's certainly no statutory basis for thinking that pre-Staggers it didn't have that authority. Okay, so what we have here then is, as we have to think about this as a court here in terms of what this statute means, is that Congress didn't change sub C in any significant way. It left it in the statute, including the second sentence, the conditioning authority, but it added subsection D. So it seems to me for you to be able to prevail here, you have to be able to show that D, the addition of D, repealed the pre-existing, pre-Staggers Act environmental conditioning authority. And since we're at Chevron 1, you have to show that that's unambiguous, right? And we have a very clear rule that repeals by implication are not favored.
Right.
So my question to you is, if that's the right standard, what's your best argument that D unambiguously repeals the board's environmental conditioning authority?
Subsection C does not say anything about the environment.
You've already departed from what I thought we had agreed on.
That the greatest
subsection
respect.
C does pre-staggers, did pre-staggers, authorize environment? I mean, if pre-staggers there was no environmental conditioning, this case is over. But I didn't remember you arguing that.
So. If pre-staggers there was public interest conditioning, uh-huh. which this court has read to mean a condition tethered to the approval standard, this is Lamoille, for the purpose of assuring that a transaction meets the approval standard. Yeah. Environmental conditions under that, if you read the statute as it was read prior to the codification, are either environmental or either public interest conditions, or they are no kind of condition. But in neither instance.
And I lost you there. Say that again.
The statute provided for conditions to assure that the transaction met the public interest standard that then and now applies to major mergers. It's a public interest condition.
And environmental conditions are part of that, right?
Pardon?
Environmental conditions are part of that.
Environmental could be part of that if it's consistent with the public interest. Uh-huh. The agency read the statute in 81 as precluding all conditions except competition conditions. The agency below ignored that decision but conceded that D, contrary to your implied repeal suggestion, constrained its conditioning authority under C.
Well, it changed C. The issue is if D changed C, which you argue it does, right? D somehow
C concedes below.
Well, I'm talking about you. Your argument is that D changes C, and I think Judge Tatel's question is, there's a pretty high burden to show that D changes C. What's your best argument to show that D changes C?
My argument that it changed it is the reading the agency gave the statute in 1981 and again below, which was that D constrained the conditioning authority of the agency under C. The board does not run away entirely from Illinois Terminal. The board calls for an exception, an environmental exception, and it justifies that exception on the basis of NEPA. The language is very explicit. And because of it is seeking an exception and is conceding an implied repeal, and because the law is very clear that when Congress issues a direct and unambiguous mandate, the specific unambiguous mandate cannot be trumped by the general conflicting mandate, the question is whether the ambiguity that the agency and counsel on different grounds, neither of which is really relevant here, urge, can't exist because the agency wants to claim authority, which it clearly does not, derive from NEPA.
Excuse me. We're at Chevron 1.
Yes, we are at Chevron 1.
So, and whether or not the statute is ambiguous, or as you say, not ambiguous, is a judgment we make. We're happy to hear what the board thinks. But on that question, we don't owe any deference to the board.
That's correct.
And we don't really even care what positions it may have taken, right, in the past, because whether this statute is clear or not is a legal judgment that we make. I didn't understand you to be arguing that one of the problems here is that the position the board is taking is inconsistent with previous positions and it hasn't explained that departure. You're making a statutory argument, right?
The board
plainly has no environmental conditioning authority under the Staggers Act. That's your argument, and that's an argument that this court has to resolve.
I agree with that.
Okay.
And now I want to come back and
make
sure that you understand exactly what I'm saying.
Go ahead.
Congress passed a statute that said, do this.
Right.
There's no doubt about that.
Which statute are we talking about? Staggers now?
If you make this finding...
Wait, there's no doubt about what?
You must approve the transaction.
Correct. But that's, of course, different from whether or not you can condition an approved transaction.
Well, that depends on whether you think a condition's a requirement.
Well...
And I haven't seen anything in any of these briefs that makes a cogent argument that a condition is not a requirement.
Under 326, the board can impose labor conditions.
The board is required to impose labor conditions. And I think there's a tremendous difference between whether the agency has discretion, as it is claiming here, to create an exception to a statutory bar, D1's bar.
Only under your theory is it an exception.
Well, it's my theory. It's the Seventh Circuit's theory. It's the agency's theory. And it was the agency's theory in 1981 where it was most explicit. That the D creates an exception. It's also...
An exception to what?
To C.
Correct. For approval.
For conditioning.
Well, that's the question before us.
Well, what? You said it was just... It was.
No, and you...
if a condition is not a requirement...
Look, I think this is a really close case. Okay, so I'm not asking you these questions because I have a particular view about it at this point. I'm trying to get you to help me think about the case through the lens we have to look at.
I'm trying to do that.
Okay, great. Okay, go ahead.
I want to come back.
Yeah.
There's a mandate issued.
Yeah.
Do this.
What's the do this?
Approve if.
That's D.
Right.
Okay. You have to approve if it's not anti-competitive.
That's right.
Okay, gotcha.
Okay.
Right.
There is a residual element of public interest conditioning, which may or may not, if you go back far enough, actually be there, but we'll take the awkward...
Isn't it there in D2? Isn't there a residual public interest conditioning in D2?
It's not a D2 case, Your Honor. There may be.
Well, I'm trying to understand how this... We're trying to understand how the statute works.
The key...
Isn't there residual conditioning interest in D2?
There is conditioning to impose competition... Condition.
No, and in D2, so you have a non-major merger. You have a determination that there are anti-competitive effects. D2 tells you that's not the end of the inquiry. You have to balance that against the public interest. And when public interest is invoked, doesn't that suggest
public
the conditioning
interest in
authority?
Transportation, which may also limit. I'm not arguing that here today,
right.
But it may or may not limit the conditioning power further. Be narrower than the broad standard that would be applied in the unlimited public interest in a D case. But if I might return to the structure and reading of the statute.
I thought I was asking that.
Yeah.
No, I'm...
You agree, by the way, don't you, that I think you do in your brief, that under D, the commission has conditioning authority for competitive concerns.
Correct. Yes.
Well, where does that come from?
It either comes from D inherently or from C.
Okay, once you say that, aren't you into Chevron 2 land?
No.
I don't understand why. I mean, you've got to find if it's possible that it comes from C, then what in the statute deprives the board of conditioning environmental conditioning?
Well, the statute, if I can include the law in this circuit.
Sure.
Lamoille says that the conditions under C have to be related to the conditioning standard. For major mergers, that's the public interest. For D1 mergers, that's whether there is going to be harm to competition. An absence of that finding.
Isn't Lamoille a major merger case?
It was not a reading, however.
But it's a major merger. It didn't deal with
reading
D.
Of the statute. Before D1 was imposed, Lamoille looked at what the statute said about conditioning power and concluded that you could not, and this was on a request by the agency, and another party, concluded that the agency could not issue conditions that were beyond the approval standard.
What was the condition at issue in Lamoille?
The request below.
Yeah, what was it?
Was what was that the board could or could have could be required to go beyond the public interest and condition the transaction?
Oh, well, of course, but an environmental condition under the Staggers Act could be consistent with the public interest.
It could be.
Yeah.
But
otherwise, the board wouldn't impose it.
The public interest was the conditioning, was the approval standard. In this case, competition is the approval standard.
So tell me once again, let's go back now. Tell me once again, what is it that would convince us that Congress, by adding D, unambiguously withdrew the commission's...
Legislative history, which is, you can take into account at Chevron
1.
You can. At Chevron 1,
we may.
Yes.
Yes, I agree.
And Congress said it wanted to limit the factors,
right,
and it wanted to shorten the process.
Didn't Congress also reject an amendment that would have exempted minor mergers?
Congress rejected a lot of
amendments. You raised legislative history, so, you know,
yes.
I mean...
Doesn't that cut both ways? Can you say Congress rejected it because it was already there, didn't need to make that explicit?
I can't explain it.
That's the problem with legislative history.
Right? Don't you think it would be a little odd that the Congress, if you're right, that Congress, which denied the commission authority to impose environmental conditions, not only rejected an amendment to exempt it, which would have been unnecessary, I guess, but also added to the national transportation policy a requirement that mergers be in the public public health and safety, protect the public health and safety.
I don't think it's odd.
You don't?
No, because the Congress at that time was in a very deregulatory mood. And I don't think that there was no question on the part of the agency or the reviewing court out of the box what this meant. There is no question on the part of the, I'm going to go to two.
But you're going to do what?
Do I get to go to two?
What's two?
Chevron two?
No, not yet.
Okay.
But you can go there when we're ready, okay? Do you agree that let's assume for a minute that your interpretation of the statute is perfectly reasonable, maybe even the best interpretation, okay? If there's another reasonable interpretation, we can't resolve this at Chevron 1, right?
Yes, but there is not.
Well, I was going to ask you about one.
There is no reasonable interpretation. The board's notion...
Go ahead.
The board's notion that it can render D effectively a nullity because it has...
I don't think that's their position.
Well,
but again, we're at Chevron 1 here.
Pardon?
We're at Chevron 1 here.
Yes, we
don't. It's not the board that has to offer a reasonable interpretation at this point.
Well, let's assume that
the
you
question
have
is,
one.
Well, I was going to ask you about one.
I don't think there is a reasonable
Let me ask you about one, okay? All right, so going back to my point that what we've got here is not a change in C, but an addition that is D. And therefore, the question is, what effect does D have on C? To me, it seems to me that's the way we have to think about this, okay? Why isn't it just as reasonable, or at least reasonable, to say that C, that the word transaction in C, both parts of C, applies to both major and minor? Because after all, unlike B and D, which are limited to the type of merger, C is not. So C applies to all mergers. D carves out a much narrower basis for the board to approve or disapprove a merger, a minor merger, but that leaves a second sentence of C in place. So the impact of D on C is to narrow the basis on which the board can approve or disapprove a merger. I know you don't agree with that, but why is that unreasonable?
Because a condition cannot be a requirement. It can be means of facilitating the meeting of a statutory requirement.
This merger was approved.
This merger was approved with a requirement that Congress said you didn't have to meet.
No,
the agency
now you're jumping into the, you're ignoring the conclusion. I mean, let's assume the condition was only cost $25. So completely cut out the fact that it wouldn't possibly have any implications for whether your client goes through the merger. Well, but the legal question is still here, okay? So what's unreasonable about, why is my suggested interpretation unreasonable? That's all I'm asking you.
It does not have any boundary. It doesn't have to be $25. It could be $25 zillion.
Uh-huh, right.
And there is no limit under your construction because it is not a public interest standard. Or is it a public interest?
Well, it is because the second sentence has the public interest standard that the first sentence does.
If it's a public interest standard.
I mean, we can contain the board. The board's conditions can be reviewed by this court. If the board has conditioning authority, obviously it can impose arbitrary and capricious conditions. It can't impose conditions that aren't in the public interest. You might even argue that it can't impose conditions that would, in effect, prohibit the merger. I'm not sure that's right or wrong.
How do we know that the board, the conditioning authority in the clause at the begins the second sentence doesn't mention the public interest?
Uh-huh. Okay, what about, all right, so your answer to my question, so I can know how to think about this, is that the reason my interpretation is not reasonable is because there's no limit to the conditioning authority, right? That's the argument.
It is not related to the approval standard.
And what do you do about
it
six?
It is unlimited.
What do you
there
do
two
about,
reasons.
And what do you do about 326?
326 is an explicit mandate, uh-huh. And that requires the board to do something, and there has to be a reconciliation between the two mandates. Uh-huh. There is no mandate in C to impose any conditions. Uh-huh.
By the way, I just have a practical question to ask you. You probably do these kinds of mergers, and you maybe know the answer. What happens if this merger has been consummated, right?
Yes, sir.
So what happens if in the end the board takes a position? Let's assume that the board has conditioning authority. Let's take the environmental out of it, okay? Let's assume they impose a condition that relates to competition. And the board allows you to consummate the merger, but the railroad doesn't comply with the condition. What happens?
The board may enforce the condition.
It can enforce it. What does it do? Go to court?
It enforces orders. It has the authority to enforce its orders.
I see. It doesn't unravel the merger. What does it do? Go to court? Or it can order the railroad to do it?
It would probably handle it administratively.
And what's its sanction? What's the sanction?
It could ask the attorney general to go to court and impose civil or criminal penalties.
Uh-huh.
If it could meet the standards.
I see. Uh-huh.
Can I go back to the statute again? Looking at C, you focused on the second sentence of C, the conditioning authority. As I read that, isn't that saying that the conditioning authority is only for those sorts of transactions for which the board needs to make a public interest finding, right? Because it says the board may impose conditions governing the transaction. That's referring to the first sentence, right?
I think that's the proper reading, because the original statute, which from which this was codified, linked the two in the same paragraph.
So if that's right, is your argument then that there's no public interest component of D2 of a D proceeding, of a D1 proceeding?
If that's right, the board has.
Because the only time Congress talks about public interest is for
major transactions.
Yeah, is for a transaction for which the only time the Congress talks about conditions expressly is when it is a major merger subject to a public interest determination. Right.
I think that's right. Although that's not where the argument's been based, but that is definitely.
And why hasn't it been based?
It hasn't been so based. Because the agency has advanced a Chevron 1 argument that this section unto itself gives it authority. Right? And we have taken that on. It is very clear, if you go back to the original statute, 5 2B. And if you look at the entire legislative history and all the commentary on this, that Congress thought the competition standard was the public interest for the purposes of this statute.
Any questions?
Can I,
yeah,
I have, yeah. Pardon me. Your Honor.
Sorry, do you want to finish your sentence?
That was not clear. The competition standard was the limit of the public interest with respect to D1.
Okay. Yes. Let me go back to the discussion you and I are having about my proposed interpretation of the statute. I just want to push you a little bit more on your reason for this. Under my theory, or my proposed interpretation, D leaves in place whatever environmental conditioning authority existed pre-Staggers. Okay? Mm-hmm. And so I'm not sure it's an answer for you to say to me the problem is it's unlimited because it's exactly what it was pre-Staggers. Whatever it was then, it is now.
No, because...
Tell me more.
It depends on how you approach it. Is the environmental condition a public interest condition or is it not?
Pre-Staggers, you had the same question.
In pre-Staggers.
I'm saying the addition of D didn't change any of those debates. In other words, however that debate would turn out pre-Staggers, it's exactly the same today.
The addition of D added a single requirement to approval. In order to tell Congress, you didn't mean that I get a license if I do this, if I show this. You may not get a license if I show this and whatever the agency.
Okay, we're beyond. You're not responding to my question. Do you want to take a couple seconds and talk about Chevron 2?
I would.
Yeah, go ahead. Give me your best Chevron 2 argument.
My best Chevron 2 is that the agency's an exception interpretation, which can get no help from counsel at Chevron 2.
Correct.
Makes absolutely no sense. Uh-huh. Nowhere. There's no statutory authority for it. NEPA doesn't require it. There's no authority in the Act. And nowhere.
That sounds like your Chevron 1 argument.
No, well, they're both the same, Your Honor. In this case.
Well, then.
Because the agency. Wait, I get to add the agency now, right?
Uh-huh.
The agency previously interpreted the statute in its only full consideration of the issue as precluding all conditions other than environmental conditions. The agency below.
All conditions other than environmental conditions?
Other than competition conditions, pardon me. The agency below said. D limits C, but for our environmental exception, and that environmental exception doesn't make any sense. There is no environmental exception because there's no statutory source for it. If Congress had said...
No, but you see, we only get to Chevron 2 if you're wrong that the statute...
I understand that. But if I'm wrong and there is some clarity that has to be added and the agency...
No, it's not any clarity. It's just the question is, okay, if you're wrong, that is, that it unambiguously...
Yes, I understand.
Okay, the question then is, has the agency reasonably interpreted the statute to give it that authority?
It's entirely unreasonable.
And why is that?
Well, because it has discretion. It's claiming discretion for one set of public interest parameters, which happen to include safety and historical buildings, but that's a different question. Uh-huh. That exception has no source. It has no source in the legislative history.
Is your point that the board, in its decision that's on review here, did not say that its environmental conditioning authority comes from the statute, but rather from NEPA?
No. My contention is the board said D limits our conditioning authority under C.
Yeah.
All right? However, environmental conditions are different. Well, as far as, when you parse it through, it pulls it from nowhere. There is no environmental exception in the legislative history of D. There is no environmental statute that independently gives it authority. It is saying we are limited in public interest conditions to competition, except the environment. Where does that come from?
And if it doesn't come from a reading of what public interest means, right? If the public interest conditioning continues despite D, then that's the source of it, isn't it?
Well, no. They're saying it doesn't continue except for the environment. Where does the exception come from? It's nonsensical, frankly. I am bound in a D1 case to approve if you show, if I find that there's, unless I find that there's likely to be harm to competition. And I may not condition it under the public interest, except I may condition it for the purposes of protecting the environment. I don't know where that exception comes
from. I'm just looking at my notes on the board's decision. I don't have the board's decision in front of me. I'm looking at my notes, and one of the reasons they give, I think, is that for having environment, they cite NEPA and things like that, but then they also say that that one of the reasons why they have environmental conditioning authorities is because the statute, nothing in the statute directly precludes the board.
That's not the law in this circuit. See back country.
Well, but see, that's in the context of the fact that pre-Staggers, they did have environmental conditioning authority. And all they're saying here, I think, is that nothing in the new statute takes it away.
I don't think that.
And I don't think that's anything different than I was asking you.
Oh, it's very different.
It is?
What they're saying. What they're saying is, I don't have any public interest conditioning authority, except related to competition, except I have environmental conditioning authority. Where does that come from? It pulls it from air. Congress created an exception to D and to any other limit on approval when it enacted 2.6 for labor. It could have enacted 2.6 for the environment. It did not. It could have said something in this list of interests that would have singled out the environment. It did not. It said nothing about it. The agency said nothing about it when it reviewed the statute. There's really no source for this except in the end.
That still sounds to me like your Chevron 1 argument. But you still haven't told me why. If you're wrong that the statute, if you're wrong about your view, you still haven't told me why their view is unreasonable.
It's unreasonable because it
says I have no. You just come back to your argument that they don't have the authority.
It's unreasonable for two reasons.
Yeah.
They say the first reason is this exception theory, which doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
The second reason is that it would, because of the way they read it, uh-huh, without limit, it would nullify the original approval statute. Uh-huh. It would give them the ability to do through a set of requirements by virtue of the fact they're operating under the rubric of condition, uh-huh, rather than requirement, what Congress told them they could not do.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Cattay. You want to move that down? There's a little button there.
That's okay. May it please the court, my name is Evelyn Cattay, and I represent the board and the United States in this case. The primary issue here is whether the board has any authority to impose environmental conditions in smaller mergers. We believe that the board did not abuse its discretion in finding that we do. Congress clearly wanted the board to do NEPA. We know that because of the legislative history just before the Staggers Act was passed, where Congress considered but decided against making NEPA inapplicable to all railroad mergers. Congress, as has come out here earlier, made changes to the approval standard by narrowing the transportation factors that the board can consider in smaller mergers in the Staggers Act. But Congress did not amend the board's separate authority to impose conditions in subsection C. Therefore, as CN repeatedly told the board for the first 11 months of this case,
are you going back to your waiver argument?
That is part of my waiver argument, Your Honor. Yeah. But even CN, our position is that even CN did not.
But that doesn't make any difference at all to us. I mean, we have to interpret this statute. We have a Chevron 1 argument before us that the railroad has presented. Unless it's waived, it doesn't really make any difference what positions the Canadian Northern Railroad took previously.
Well, it's only relevant, Your Honor, because it shows that even the railroad itself
What's that got to do with us?
Nothing.
I mean, the railroad, right. Okay. So, unless you want to make your waiver argument, is that what you want to do?
We stand by our forfeiture and waiver argument, but since nobody's asked questions about it or discussed it,
maybe
I think
you can just tell me one thing about
brief.
It, which is, as I understand, your major concern, the board's major concern in this, in the waiver argument, is that no one had a chance to respond, right?
That is not the, that is one concern that we had, Your Honor, and that would be consistent with the...
But they filed their comment within the time frame, right?
They filed a comment in response to the EIS, to the draft EIS. So it was not that it was untimely. Clearly, the railroad can file comments and often does file comments, but it was, you know, page 148,
so
150-page comments.
Is there anything in the requirement that the comments had to be on the first page?
I think that it was not an argument that was forcefully raised. First of all, when they described it themselves, they described this as unclear. They never really made the argument. Mm-hmm. But as the court has recognized in the Otter Tail case,
well,
you have to.
They made the argument very true. They made it on the last day and they made it at the end, but they made it strongly.
They made
said
it,
the board does not have environmental conditioning authority.
They made it, but
when would you have them make it? What's the rule that you would have us follow?
During scoping, the board specifically said that the alternatives that it would look at in this case were grant, deny, and grant with conditions. The board said
the first time they've got to bring it up there. What's the nature of notice and comment? Isn't it a fluid sort of thing that parties are allowed to?
Well, I think that then we issued decision two, and in decision two we announced that we were going to do an EIS, and that again that the alternatives that we would
look at. I understand the facts here. What I'm asking you is, so when would you require a party?
I think it's what's reasonable in the circumstances.
They gave you what's reasonable in the circumstances. That's not going to help you here.
Well, we
you
don't
had
think
full
so,
notice.
Because there was no opportunity.
Were you prejudiced in any way by them coming in with?
The board was not prejudiced, but other litigants, like communities, could not respond and could not present their point of view.
How were they prejudiced?
Because they had no opportunity to respond.
Because they filed it on the last day? But see, that's the board's responsibility. You had a period of time when people could file simultaneous comments. And, I mean, if the board had wanted to be sure everybody could respond, you could have had a separate period for people to add additional comments in response to comments, but you didn't do that.
Well, if we had done that, the railroad would have screamed because it was trying so hard to get this case expedited and decided as quickly as possible.
My only point is that they filed their comments within the time frame.
They did, Your Honor.
On the last day, and the fact that nobody had a chance to respond isn't their fault. It's the board's responsibility.
We think that this is a stronger waiver argument than this court, with Judge Henderson writing the opinion, recently decided in the BNSF case, where the agency stayed silent for 3 years. And here, the railroad specifically was suggesting throughout that we had this authority that all of a sudden it describes as unclear on page 148 of its DEIS comments. But I would be happy to turn to the merits, because I think that's what the court is mostly interested in.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that it's clear that, as Judge Tatel said, this may be a close case, but that if the court addresses the merits, the statute is, as CN said in its DEIS comments, unclear and ambiguous, and therefore falls within Chevron 2.
I'm sorry, who said that?
CN said that in its comments on the DEIS. CN itself described this as unclear.
You're wasting your limited time by talking about CNN's view about its previous view.
Okay, well,
the question here is this statute unambiguous as CN insists? Assume for a minute that the issue is properly before us.
I don't think that you can argue that the statute is unambiguous.
Okay, tell us why.
The board's interpretation is permissible because Congress took certain things off the table in the Staggers Act when it changed the substantive criteria for smaller mergers and adopted D. But environmental review and environmental mitigation is not among the things that Congress took off the table. We know that Congress thought about it and that it decided against making NEPA inapplicable in all railroad mergers. That was shown by this H.R. 7235.
Right.
But Congress did not specifically say that the board must do NEPA or that the board can't impose environmental mitigation. And NEPA itself specifically says that environmental issues are to be taken into account to the maximum extent possible. Congress
What's your answer to Mr. Cunningham's argument in response to my proposed interpretation of the statute, that the problem with my suggestion is that the commission's there's no limit to the commission's conditioning authority.
We think that there are absolutely are limits.
What are those?
Limits to the board's conditioning authority. First of all, as the board has repeatedly said in a number of recent mergers, we focus on competition because of D in determining.
We're not talking about a competition. Related, we're talking about an environmental condition.
Well, yes, but in addition, we do labor conditions, we do environmental conditions,
but
and we do conditions.
But don't answer my question by telling me what you do. Answer the question by explaining to me what the limit is on it. I know the board does it. What's the limit? His argument is that my interpretation of the statute's unreasonable because Congress would never have given the board an unconstrained conditioning authority.
But Congress gave that to the board long before the Staggers Act. The Staggers Act section that we're looking at, which is the second section in two, says the board may impose conditions governing the transaction. But that's what it's always said.
Can you answer my question? The condition, I'm sorry, Judge Tittle.
Let me just follow the board.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry, I didn't. Okay.
Suppose the board, let's assume you had a case where you had a merger, it's a small merger like this, okay? And everybody agrees that as a consequence of the merger, there will be traveling across these tracks 25 trains a day of radioactive waste, okay? So the board says, this condition is in the public interest because it's pro-competitive, there's no competition problems, but as a condition, and let's assume the merger is $100 million, okay? And the board says, okay, you can do that, but we have to protect the community from this radioactive waste. And that's going to require actions that cost another $100 million. And the railroad says, forget, it's no longer economical. Can the board impose that condition?
I think the question is whether the conditions imposed are reasonable, and I think that the board does not address pre-existing conditions. It only looks at transaction-related conditions.
That's what
the
mine
railroad
were.
Thinks.
That's what mine were. Mine was a totally transaction-related condition.
It's for the board to weigh the public interest in granting the merger against the harms to communities and to come up with reasonable conditions. And if the railroad thinks that the conditions are unreasonable, it can either file a petition to reopen or reconsider, which it did not do here, or can challenge it in court, which is where we are with the grade separation condition that the board imposed.
Right. Okay. So the answer then is that the board with its conditions has to act reasonably, not arbitrarily, and we can review that. And your position is that even if it makes the merger uneconomical, that's okay. I'm not saying that's wrong. I just want to know your position.
I don't think it's necessarily okay because I think that the railroad.
I know, but it wouldn't be a reason for us to set aside a condition simply because it made the merger uneconomical.
Well, our authority is permissive, and so the railroad chooses whether to exercise the authority or not, and has the if our condition is unreasonable. Because it totally guts the transaction and maybe it's not entirely justified by the environmental, consequences, then, as I said, the railroad can do something about it.
But the reason I ask is, the railroad's argument here is, look, D says if there's no competition problems, you must approve it. That's what the Seventh Circuit says. And if you impose a condition of the kind I put, then you're in effect not approving the merger. Okay. That's our argument.
Right. Well, our position is that we look at the competition under D, that is an approval standard, and that C only relates to, as it applies to a small condition, only relates to conditioning, and that there's nothing in C that says we cannot impose conditions in smaller mergers, and there's nothing in D that says that approval must be conditional. And that's true, as I think you mentioned earlier, with labor protection, which is not specifically mentioned in 11324 at all.
Their answer to that is that 326 is mandatory.
Well, there is a separate statutory section, but if you buy their Chevron 1 argument, you would never get to labor protection because there's nothing else to look at. It's also true, including in many mergers involving CN, that we impose safety integration plan conditions. And where do we get the authority to do that under their authority, under their interpretation? No, this was not only in major mergers. Mm-hmm. And we have done environmental review in several cases involving CN over the years. It's also true that contemporaneous with Staggers, the board has had several environmental rulemakings where we have consistently taken the position that the environmental treatment is exactly the same for big mergers and small mergers, and that our authority to impose environmental conditions is the same, and we've done that, including in mergers, you know, involving CN. And we do not read Lamoille and the Illinois Terminal case that CN has argued about today as limiting or being inconsistent with the board's discretion because they're inapposite. Lamoille, as you said, I think, earlier, involved major mergers. The issue there was whether the ICC had abused its discretion in not imposing any conditions, and the case had absolutely nothing to do with environmental conditions. And in fact, because it was small mergers, it's footnote 3 is clearly dicta because nobody is contesting that the board has the authority to impose environmental conditions in major mergers. Mm-hmm. The Illinois Terminal case, the issue there was whether the board could use its conditioning power to look at purchase price, which is something that we looked at on the merits prior to Staggers, and Staggers took off the table. And so the ICC said in that context that we did not have conditioning power that extended to the kind of condition that was requested in that case. Again, nothing to do with environmental, nothing to do with the prior experience of always applying NEPA in merger cases. And the potential environmental impacts do not depend on the size of the carrier. They depend on the particular communities involved and the amount of traffic that's going to increase. And here we have traffic increases of from 15 to 24 trains a day. Also, a lot of mergers do not even trigger NEPA because we have categorical exclusions and thresholds, and we do not do a NEPA review unless the increases are going to exceed 3 to 8 trains a day. So it's not as if we're out there imposing all these horrible conditions on railroads. And CN, you know, it came in with lots of voluntary mitigation, and they're perfectly happy that we take that mitigation, and they're challenging one condition, and it's clear that we wouldn't be here, as CN's counsel effectively acknowledged before this court, if it weren't for this one this one grade separation condition that they don't like. But
well, it's expensive.
It's expensive, but it was also very well justified, which I can go into now if you're interested. Well,
tell me what's wrong with. I agree with Judge Tatel. I think this is a close call, but let me give you my reading of the statute, and then you tell me what's wrong with it. As I see it, the history here is that under C, Congress gave to the board enormous power to review these mergers with significant consequences, right? If the STB approves the merger, there are other provisions that say you've got a safe harbor from other laws there. So the authority they gave them in C is significant authority. It's limited only by finding in the public interest, right? They're allowed to approve the merger and condition it in the public interest. That got to be a fairly expensive a process, and so isn't what's happening here that Congress has created a safe harbor for a certain type of merger, a non-major merger, and in an effort to speed these up in a deregulatory atmosphere, has said the only thing we want you to look at in these cases is whether there's an anti-competitive effect, and if there's no anti-competitive effect, STP, approve it. You have to approve it. Fast track, we want to get these things going. Now, what's wrong with that reading?
That is, in our view, that is a permissible interpretation of the statute, as we said in our brief.
Right.
But it is not the only interpretation, and it is not required, because when you look at the history, when you look at the fact that we were clearly doing or able to do NEPA before, and that Congress in the legislative history thought about but did not go forward and remove NEPA from all railroad mergers. And if you look at
legislative
history, it's just legislative history.
You're looking the wrong way on the bench on legislative history.
But it shows, Your Honor, that
look down there.
I mean, if it weren't so specific, I would tend to agree with you. But here, the statute is unclear, and this is what we have. We have prior, you know, we have, and this legislative history is.
Well, then,
very on point.
Why isn't the best reading of C, the conditioning authority, that it is linked solely to those transactions in which Congress has given the STP express authority to consider the public interest? Because it says the board may impose conditions governing the transaction, and it's referring to transactions in which the Congress has given the board authority to invoke public interest.
Well, our view is, again, your interpretation or that interpretation is permissible, but it's not the best because it excludes any ability by the board to do anything for communities that are adversely impacted. And the board's interpretation is a permissible interpretation of the statute. And even if this court would read it differently because the statute is ambiguous, our interpretation should be approved, and it gives, you know, in Isaac Walton League, this court said we do not do repeals of NEPA by implication, and you should harmonize different federal statutes. NEPA itself says that you're supposed to take environmental consequences into account to the maximum extent possible. And this is not a case where we are relying solely on NEPA to give us the necessary authority, because in C, the statute continues to say the board may impose conditions on a transaction. It was not changed, and there is no legislative history that suggests that Congress was unhappy with that interpretation. And in 1994, the ICC did a big report to Congress where it said the ICC may impose, you know, conditions. And Congress, again, made significant changes to our statute in 1996 in ICTA and never suggested. By then, it was very clear that we were doing environmental reviews and in mergers where appropriate, and Congress never indicated that it had any problem with our interpretation. So we think this is a permissible interpretation, and that the conditions that we imposed are entirely reasonable under the circumstances presented here. In terms of the, are you interested in the grade separation? I mean, and why we did not impose a grade separation condition in Barrington? I don't believe that was addressed, or at least forcefully addressed, in the opening brief. But the board did reasonably find that grade separations in Ogden Avenue and Lincoln Highway were reasonable and properly declined to impose one in Barrington.
I do have a question about the community's argument about the selection of the consultant.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. I mean, it doesn't look like the board. Well, let me ask you this. How many? There's like 80 companies on this list, right?
I'm not sure the number, but certainly they're over 50.
Yeah, okay. Is there any indication that anybody ever didn't get on the list who wanted to be on it?
You have to meet certain qualifications to get on the list.
I know, but do you know whether anybody...
I can't answer that, Your Honor, but I believe that if the environmental staff felt that this was not a qualified consultant, they would not be on the list.
Right, but you don't know whether or not, I mean, I guess I'm asking whether this is, you know, essentially kind of an open list that people just get on, you know, if they've done environmental work in the railroad industry.
I think it is.
You see why I'm asking the question, because if it is, then it doesn't look like the board.
Well, that's not the end of the story, Your Honor. What happened here is that the railroad sent our environmental staff a letter and asked that the environmental staff approve the use of HDR as the third-party contractor. And then the environmental staff wrote
we've said in that Burlington case that approval is not the same as concurring in their choice.
Didn't we? It's clear that the agency can have...
Didn't we say that? Yeah. We said that, that's not approval.
Said here.
Burlington.
In that case, the applicant selected the contractor, and the contractor never executed the disclosure form. Here, the contractor executed the disclosure form.
Right, but, secondly, but I'm asking you about who selected the consultant and...
Well, our position is that the railroad had input into the process, but that the board, it was the board that retained ultimate responsibility for the final selection of the contractor.
Do you know whether the board has ever rejected a request to appoint a particular...
I think that normally what happens is that a railroad planning to do a transaction will come in and talk to the environmental staff, and then there's discussion about possible contractors, and I think that if an applicant suggested perhaps asking the environmental staff to approve a contractor that didn't have the kind of expertise that was likely to be required, they would say no.
No, that's not my question. My question is, you have a list of 80 possible contractors, and, you know, if that's a highly selective list and there's evidence that that the board, not anybody can get on, it's not just an open list, then I see your argument. You're saying, look, these are the ones we have selected, and they are just picking one of them, right?
Yes, and they're all considered to be...
But, of course, that isn't right, but
well,
if
they have different expertise. I think if you have a minor abandonment case or something, you would have, perhaps you'd have different expertise. When we look at a case like this, which is likely to involve, does involve multiple environmental issue areas, then you look to see... among the larger contractors that have experience in this kind of case, who the appropriate contractors should be. And there's nothing whatsoever suggesting that HDR here didn't do a great job. They executed a disclosure statement. They prepared a comprehensive EIS. There was ample opportunity for public comment. Yeah. There's no case law. I mean,
one of their arguments has to do with these hazardous waste spills, and The EIS said that there would be one spill a year, and that was remote, right?
What we said is that the chance of a spill at any particular location would be remote.
Yeah, but I'm asking you about they did say across the whole line there'd be one spill a year, right?
Yes, there definitely
and
spills.
And the board said that's remote.
At any particular location.
No,
what we said.
You're missing my point. I understand at each of the segments they said, but the board also said the EIS calculates based on past experience on these two carriers that there'll be one spill year. Didn't it?
I'm not positive, Your Honor.
I think it did.
They very well might have. I don't have that statistic available right at this moment. But what we said was that the chance...
Well, why don't you just assume I'm right and that it's
okay.
Spill a year, and the board said, we don't have to worry about that because one spill a year is remote.
Well, that's
Does that sound
not the
remote
end
of, to you?
No, Your Honor, but that is not the entire... I mean, whether it's one spill a year or three spills a year, mm-hmm. potentially, the point is that there are all kinds of federal, state, and local requirements that already apply to the hazardous materials transportation.
I got that argument. The board said, look, there's all these environmental laws, right? I understand that. That's not a hard argument. I'm just asking you, this was one of the reasons the board gave. The board said, or the EI, I don't remember where it came from, but they said... There's going to be one spill a year, we project, but that's too remote a consideration to take into account. I was only asking you about whether that isn't pretty arbitrary and capricious.
Something
happening once a year doesn't sound remote to me. I have a birthday once a year. That isn't remote.
I think when you look at the entire record, nothing. I mean, the board has no obligation to impose any mitigation.
Right. I understand your entire record argument, okay? All good government lawyers make that argument. And many times you win. I just am asking about whether this particular consideration, which is in the board's decision, isn't problematic.
I think it just shows that there are potential environmental impacts. There's no requirement, as long as we consider mitigation, that we impose any mitigation in a major in any kind of a merger case, because that is the board's call. And here, there's lots of mitigation. There are 12 voluntary mitigations that deal with hazmats. There's two additional mitigations that the board imposed. The EIS carefully explains that the containment systems would not have done any good.
Those had nothing to do with hazardous
Oh, yes, they do. They're all related to hazardous materials. I mean, basically, what the board was saying is there's a whole statutory scheme out there, federal, state, and local laws that deal with hazardous materials, and that plus the mitigation that the railroad proposed and the additional mitigation that we imposed was sufficient to deal with the potential problems of hazardous material spills. It's also true that, you know, CN is going to fix up that line, which will make it less likely that there's a spill, and to the extent that there's any greater danger of problems with hazardous materials on the EJ and E line, there'll be less hazardous materials that travel on the lines in Chicago. But ultimately, the board's primary obligation is to consider interstate commerce and to weigh the public benefits of this transaction, which are very significant. And I think that what the board clearly addressed the concerns that were raised by the communities and EPA and the Department of Interior and everybody else about hazardous materials, and reasonably found that the mitigation that we did impose with the existing statutes that already apply are sufficient to deal with this. And the board thoroughly explained its mitigation choices. The communities don't like the mitigation, but the determination of appropriate mitigation is for the agency and shouldn't be second-guessed by the court.
Have you finished?
Yeah, I'm done.
All right, thank you. Let's see, Mr. Shays has how much time? Okay.
Thank you. A couple of things. First of all, to your question, Judge Tatel, we made an argument on page 41 and 42 of the opening brief. I think it's a forceful and specific argument about the absence of proper analysis and consideration of mitigation on grade crossings in Barrington. The board responded on page 66
cite the study?
The cite to the opening brief?
Yeah, in the opening brief.
Page 41, 42.
There's a cite there to the to Barrington's traffic study.
There is a discussion. I don't know if there's a cite to
but
the.
That was the question I asked you.
I'm sorry. I thought you asked whether we had raised the issue.
No, I asked you whether there was a cite in the blue brief to the traffic study. I said I knew you raised the issue. I asked you whether you would. I said to you that the. That your argument, as I understood it, in the reply brief, is that your traffic study showed it was over the threshold. And I said to you, I thought that was a strong argument that the board had to respond to. And then I said, did you raise that in your blue brief?
Okay, I misunderstood the question. The answer is no. There is no cite to the study in the opening brief.
So it's waived, right?
No, Your Honor, it's not waived. The argument was raised. We specifically identify the requirement of NEPA to consider our comments.
Look, the way this works is, you know, if you've got a major piece of evidence that you want us to consider, you've got to put it before us in your blue brief, and you've got to give the other side a chance to respond. And the commission, this is a very powerful piece of evidence you have, and you did not give the board a chance to respond.
Your Honor, I think if you look at page 66 of the board's brief, you'll see that they did respond.
All right, so I'll just look at page 66 and I'll tell you what I think later. Okay.
With respect to the question of waiver, comment was made that CN raised the substantive issue in the DEIS comments, and there was a question about whether the public or community petitioners would be prejudiced by them raising it at that time. The DEIS comments were due on September 30th. Of 2008. That was not the first opportunity in the case to raise this issue, but the important point, I believe, on the issue of prejudice is that it was the last opportunity for members of the public or community petitioners to weigh in on that issue. And for months and months and months, the 8,500 people who eventually filed comments on that same day believed that we were on the same playing field, that NEPA applied. And it is possible, certainly it is possible, that members of the public, other agencies of the government, or even the community petitioners could have, after September 30th, tried to brief this issue. But we believed that CN meant what it said in the earlier parts of the case, where it consistently was on the playing field of NEPA. What are the alternatives? What are the conditions? What is the mitigation? Thank you.
Let's see, Mr. Cunningham, we'll give you 1 minute.
Let me come back to this, to 2 points. First, what the ICC said in the beginning in 81 applied to all conditions. Second, the statutory structure at Chevron 1. At Chevron 1, we have a mandate. As Judge Griffith recognized, C, by the natural reading, applies to major transactions. The board said C is limited in the case of D1 transactions, and we don't get to D2 unless we flunk D1.
What do you do with the language of B and D?
B and D apply to major transactions.
Well, no, B applies to major, D to minor, but C says nothing. It just says a transaction.
I think the construction.
I'm sorry, did I say that wrong? I'm sorry, I said that wrong.
The statute is entirely.
I wasn't asking you about Judge Griffith's interpretation. I was asking you about the statute, and you said C applies only to major transactions, right? Isn't that what you just said?
I said that C.
I mean, yes, C. Didn't you say C applies?
C can be read to apply to major transactions.
And to
it can be applied, read to apply both places.
Okay.
But it cannot be read.
Go ahead.
We do not believe the second reading is a permissible reading.
What, that it can
because
be
because it nullifies Congress' purpose in enacting D1, which
not
was
if you
to
read, not if you
take
read.
Out the public interest conditions. They didn't want factors other than competition.
If
considered.
Congress wanted to do that, they could have easily changed C to have said as B and D do.
Could have.
Didn't do that. It left that unamended. So your argument is that they repealed this. It's an implied repeal.
My argument is that D1 means what it says, and there is no.
Well, if D1 meant what it said, we wouldn't have spent the last.
There is no. It does. D1 means what it says. D1 means what it says, and the only permissible readings are those that permit it to say what it says.
Okay.
By the way, the public interest standard was unlimited when there were only public interest transactions, the conditioning power, until it was limited in Lamoille. Yeah. That does not mean that it is subsequently limited. I also want.
All right, that's enough.
Thank you very much.
Case, please.